Welcome to the 40K Lorecast.
Welcome to the 40K Lorecast with me, John Barsotti, and Brad Chester.
This guy.
Hey, Brad, how much sleep did you get last night?
Carry the 1-0. I did change my shirt for you because I thought about it.
Yeah, so we are recording this show about 13 hours after we've recorded the last one. One of us, I probably got like 6 hours of sleep, which is an impossible number more than Brad because he got 0. I can't even give you the percentage. So one of us feels fresher.
I think I look fantastic. We should be live for this.
Yeah. Yeah. The good thing is that thanks to your heart and brain, you can easily consume lots of caffeine to make yourself feel better, right?
Yeah, I never liked you.
Anyway, today we're going to jump into all the models John used to own with his Ultramarine army, and I'm missing now because of this cast. Are some of them not that interesting? Yeah.
Whoa. How dare you besmirch the good name of Teleon in Kronos, because I know you don't know where your Kronos is, do you?
Well, I've sold them all. Unfortunately, I did sell the entire army off, and I will be honest, all of these models on the board are mostly kind of okay, but they all in the lore have hilariously over the top stories. And I was trying to think about it. I'm wondering if the Ultramarines have the most OP stories for random dudes.
Possibly, because their random guys are always in like 2 and 3 day fights.
That's why.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I'm not taking anything away from Dante or Grimnar or any of those people. They have epic stories. The thing is, the Ultramarines will have Ted. And what did Ted do? Oh, Ted punched 2 Carnifexes to death with his bare hands.
What? Sandwich.
Yeah. So also of note today, I mentioned last week, but I'm going to say it again. We are not going to cover Titus today. And that's because we're going to do a full cast on the Space Marine games, just like we're going to be doing some full cast on the Dawn of War games as we get into the end of 2025 with some updates happening to those games. But before we go,
this is also John's fault because I've been trying to do Space Marine games forever. And we said we couldn't do them early because we would spoil things for people. So yeah, this is hurtful, but we're doing it now. So my sad face. Well, eventually.
Yeah. We'll get to them eventually. Yeah. 40K Lorecast, weekly show on the lore of Warhammer 40K universe, releasing every Monday at 7 p.m. Please continue.
Eastern Standard Time. Come on.
Eastern Standard Time. Exactly. Big thank you to everybody who's been commenting so far. It's an incredible way for us to get pushed out. We're the number one Warhammer Lorecast in the world right now, and that's thanks to all of you listeners. So huge thank you there. Additionally, if you enjoy Brad and I and want more of us, you can click the link over to our YouTube page where you can find the 40K Lorecast YouTube. There's going to be old versions of the show that we've converted over with imagery and subtitles, all of our live Q&A sessions, and our other shows, the history of 40K, the focus on the history of the tabletop of the game, and Two Old Men and Their Handler, which is a focus more on the competitive side, talking about individual units and what makes them good or not good within the game. Last little bit in the show notes, link to our Patreon. Massive thank you to everyone who's contributed already. Anyone who's been listening long enough knows the audio quality is mildly better than it used to be. But more importantly, it's really helping us expand out and do a lot more with ourselves. We know people want more from us and we want to do more with this. Thanks to the Patreon, we can afford to buy better equipment, put on some events, actually start traveling to some events. Really has been incredible. And the way that our Patreon works is if you sign up to our Patreon, you get the show and the history show ad-free. It's only $4.99 US. Or if you live in Palau, it's also $4.99 US because they use the US dollar, despite not being part of the US, due to something called a Compact of Free Association.
I need everyone to know how excited you were when you found this out.
And I didn't know you could do this. I assumed you couldn't just use someone else's currency as your own.
Was the first 5 minutes of us recording was him just telling me, about this.
I learned this, yeah, what were you, 3 minutes ago, 5 minutes ago, and wrote the notes because I was going to cover something else about Palau, which I do like, which is that they've got a giant lake there called the Jellyfish Lake, where you can swim with millions of stingless jellyfish, which I'm going to be honest with you, that's a sign I'm going to read multiple times. When it says, hey, go ahead and jump in this lake that's full of millions of jellyfish, but don't worry, they don't sting. I'm just going to go with, I'm going in second.
Going in second.
But I do want to go there now because it sounds super cool. All right. Last little bit, though, as always, Discord. We're over 10,000 members strong now, which is an incredible achievement. And I really want to thank everyone for joining it and being part of it.
It's a great place to come in. We've got everything from 40K lore to talking about movies to the best thing to eat. The fitness channel is crushing. And it's super friendly to new people and people that are experienced with the game, the lore, the whatever. It's just a really fun place to be. We also have one of my favorites, the meme page. Yes.
Yes, Brad does love himself some memes.
I do.
All right. So if you haven't joined, the link's in the show notes. Come on in. We'd be happy to have you. But on to the heroes of the Imperium, the characters of the Ultramarines. So we're going to start today with someone who I used to love putting on the board, mostly because my opponent would say, who is that? And I would say, it's Torias Talion. And then they would ask me, well, what does he do? And I would tell them, and they would give me a bewildered look, shrug their shoulders, just move on with their day. Because to be fair, he was kind of useless most of the time. But every now and then, magically, he was not.
I love everything about the fact that you knew his first name. If you would have put a gun to my head, I would have been able to tell you. He's just telling you.
I'll be honest, if I put a gun to your head, but put seven Ultramarine characters on the board, I'm not sure if you could pick out Talion. Like, I guess he does look like a sniper, but...
He's got a sniper.
Because all he did was he made your snipers plus one to hit, but every now and then you put him near, because before we lost him to Legends, unfortunately, but you'd put him near scout squads and every now and then they'd pick off an enemy character. And in an era of the game where that was a lot more devastating because it was really hard to shoot characters in 8th and 9th edition. Yeah. So let's dive into the story of Torias Talion, though. So first and foremost, he's a 300-year-old scout. And for those of you who've forgotten or don't know, scouts are a fancy term for neophytes, which are the new Space Marine initiates vying for their right to become full Space Marines. They're always teenagers, but they're teenagers that are filled with gene seed organs and steroids. We're calling it what they really are.
If you go to our Discord, we have a fantastic meme about me protecting my guys with my scouts.
Yeah, Brad loves to take these child soldiers and sacrifice them to enemy melee combatants, rejoicing as world leader berserkers. Yeah, rejoicing as world leader berserker squads massacre the children, keeping his cowardly elite space marine safe at a distance while watching children die. Just saying, that's what scouts are. Stop. If you play Space Marines, stop sacrificing your scouts to the enemies. Those are the future of your Space Marine army. Treat them. Children are our future. Anyway, unlike Lucas the Trickster, though, Talion has never advanced beyond scout by choice. This is not a punishment. Talion has chosen to remain amongst the ranks of neophytes for 300 years and counting, because unlike Brad, he recognizes that the children of the Space Marines are the future.
He wants to guide them, as opposed to making sure I'm not getting charged on turn one by world leaders.
Yeah. Yeah, it's okay. Just go ahead and sacrifice them out, and then don't complain when you have no Space Marines left because you killed all your initiates. Talion knows he's one of the greatest warriors in the galaxy, but as one warrior, he can only affect a single battle at a time. So as a leader and as an educator of warriors, he can affect all of the battles all over the galaxy. And so that's why he's decided to stay back in his progression through the ranks, choosing to stay a sergeant and training the aspirants of the Ultramarines to greatness, which is actually really cool because if you think about it, that means that the scouts underneath him are being trained by one of the greatest warriors within all of the Ultramarines. It's kind of a good deal. I'm thinking of a Starship Troopers, whatever that guy's name was, who was training them all in basic training.
You mean Michael Ironside?
Yeah, the actor, but not, no idea what the name is.
Who needs to know who he is in the movie? Michael Ironside plays Michael Ironside. He's
awesome. In every single movie. So we should mention that Tellian, by the way, is good at everything, but he's especially good. I mean, it's listed that way. He's a master of hand-to-hand combat, but what he really is good at is sneaking and shooting. He, depending on what you're reading, he's kind of a Vindicare assassin.
He's got some crazy lore in the fact that he's taken out some big targets, but he's also like been the super sneaky sniper guy from the movies that is inside the defenses of the enemy and doing all kinds of crazy stuff. He's done a bunch of lone op shit too.
That's the thing. So an example is, I will say, his plot armor is like Terminator thick. So when he does stuff, it is super over the top. So for example, they're fighting Chaos and he takes the scouts of the 10th company to infiltrate this dark mechanicum forge on Kuntarn, close enough. While there, the 5th and 6th companies are engaging with this like dark mechanicum force. And the dark mechanicum force is just replicating vehicles so fast that the Ultramarines can't make ground. So Tellian and his squad infiltrate in and blow up every single one of the Mechanicum forges. And apparently the Dark Mechanicum don't notice him because he's just that sneaky. He didn't blow up one, by the way. He blew up multiple by being sneaky. Then, fast forward a little bit or back, against the orcs in the world of Blackreach. There's an orc Wah, and the Ultramarines are there. They could not find the war boss to end the assault. But Tellian had a very cunning plan. And what I'm about to give you is canon. Tellian.
I have to pause on this because you said he had a cunning plan and I know this story. Continue on. I had to put a warning label on this.
Yeah, it's a cunning plan. So Tellian knows. Well, it's cunning. He knows the orcs are going to come loot something.
Cunning,
so
but brutal orc style.
Yeah. So he hides while the orcs come and loot it. And then he tracks. It turns out the reason they can't find the orcs is because the war boss has a submarine. And he then follows the submarine. They don't say how, by the way. I'm assuming he just held his breath and held on to it. Indiana Jones style.
No, come on. Give him Captain America style at least, man.
I was going Indiana Jones. That's the he does that.
Or no, it was Magneto that also did that.
A lot of people have held onto a submarine. Yeah. So he tracks
so many superheroes. Hold on.
And by the way, where was this super secret lair, Brad?
I mean, where is it going to be? Hold on. If you could see me, I'm doing my Dr. Evil pinkies.
It was behind a waterfall because it's the 41st millennia. We've got Melta weapons. You've got warp travel, Titanic robots, but they couldn't scan through a waterfall.
Let's talk about this. In every game, if you're playing and there's a waterfall, you just push your character up against it and just see where you're going to hit the secret that's behind it. Because that's how games
are. It's just, So in this one, the orcs were hiding a secret base behind a waterfall and the Ultramarines couldn't find it.
Which they could scan immediately, but continue.
Luckily, Tellian was able to hold onto a submarine and snuck back into the base and radioed in for support. Also, another great one of Tellian was fighting the Tau. Tellian single-handedly ended the siege of Palaia with a 1-2-shot combo. From what is described as an almost impossible distance, he killed the Tau commander and the Ethereal accompanying with him with one back-to-back, pop-pop, and took them both out, removing the leadership of the Tau and then easily winning the day.
The opportunity to say, kill two cowfish with one stone. But you really missed that one, man. Come on.
Well, fair enough. Now, my favorite story, though, because it is the absolute dumbest and most over the top, is against the Tyranids. So old One Eye has returned and he's on Kalth, ripping through the defenders. If you guys don't know who old One Eye is, it's a super Carnifex who is missing an eye. And has been a rather thorny.
Because another guy shot him in the eye point blank with a Melta gun, which is pretty significant.
And he survived that. I'm going to point out. So old One Eye is alive because he took a Melta gun to the face. Anyway, old One Eye is ripping through all the defenders because he's got incredible amounts of armor on him and no one could do anything about it until Tellion arrives. And Tellion sees Old One Eye near a ravine because, of course, he's near a ravine. Takes aim with, I believe it was his pistol, and shoots Old One Eye in the face, right in the bad eye, which makes Old One Eye freak out and then fall backwards into the ravine.
He fell down.
That's a story.
Basically,
he fell off a cliff because he was standing on the edge of a cliff and then got shot in the face.
Where else would you stand if it wasn't going to be the edge? Thank you very much, sir. Where else would you stand?
Yeah, I'm a fan of Tellion. We lost him to Legends. We lost almost all of these people to Legends, unfortunately.
Here's one of my favorites. But,
yes, let's jump on. We did ranged. Let's do melee. Ortan Cassius, also known as Chaplain Cassius.
Also known, he's known 100% as Chaplain Cassius.
Yeah. Some people call him Ortan, probably Khalgar. But anyway.
His mom?
Yeah, exactly. Now, I'll say, Chaplain Cassius hates two things in this universe, Xenos and other Xenos. That's all he cares about. And he hated them forever. This led him to join the Death Watch. And he would join the Death Watch, by the way, as a chaplain. So he's in the Xeno hunting killing division of the Space Marines. And he's the guy meant to inspire their faith and hatred towards Xenos. So he had some strong opinions on this.
He was definitely putting out a newsletter, probably doing a podcast about this.
Yeah. Yeah, I can also feel pretty confident. He probably was not there when Gilliman was roaming around with Eldar next to him. Yeah. I don't think that would have gone well.
I have some opinions about this, sir. Yeah.
But Cassius has some really impressive history. So first one is while he was with the Death Watch, he holds this unique honor. In 680, which is pretty late, by the way, of M41, the Imperium discovered the first gene stealer cult. Not the first one ever, but the first one they discovered.
Cassius, this is why the gene stealer cults are so insidious. They're like, we found this thing exists. And the gene stealer cults are like, how did it take this long?
Yeah, like we've been doing this for a long time.
Hive worlds taken over. What is happening? Yeah.
But Cassius leads the kill team that purges the planets. The way it works is Cassius and the team first found them. They radio back, they discover it, and they actually saved the Hive world because they went door to door killing these things. And that was Cassius. Cassius then returns to the Ultramarines afterwards, but his thirst for Xeno killing is not quenched. Good news for him, that's when the Tyranids attacked. So he is on McCreg when the Tyranids attack, standing shoulder to shoulder with Khalgar as they'd repelled High Fleet Behemoth. Later, and that's one of my favorite ones, is he's deployed with a relief force to halt this pushback the Tyranids are doing at one of the polar fortresses. Because unlike the galaxy, planets have magnetic north and south. While there...
That's, you know what? I don't really like your tone today, John. You need to rock that back about 10%, sir.
But while they're fighting, he goes mano a mano with the Carnifex, and it doesn't go well. The Carnifex effectively rips him to shreds, and the apothecaries decide that they could rebuild him. They have the technology to make him better than he was. Better, stronger, faster. Okay, maybe not, but the metal model.
How many people are going to get this reference that we just made? I don't know. But look that up.
Yeah, it's not that good of a show. The show's older than me. But what I do like is that it's written that after they put him back together, there is less than a centimeter, so less than half an inch for us Americans, of his body that is free of scars. He is completely ripped to shreds, and most of him actually is robotic at this point. The cool thing about Cassius, though, where he's really important to the Ultramarine lore is that as the story has developed, the Ultramarines have been pulled all around the galaxy to fight a whole host of threats, but Cassius has remained steadfast, focusing on Xenos, primarily the Tyranids. So he's one of the big ones leading key strikes into Hive fleets. Anytime the Tyranids are involved, Cassius comes in.
He hangs out with the Tyrannic veterans too.
Yeah, who we also lost to Legends. We lost a bunch of stuff to Legends.
Those were a lot of really cool dudes too.
Oh, the Tyrannic veterans were really good models. Really good models. And so was Cassius.
We lost a lot of stuff to Legends, which for everybody listening, Legends is our models in 40K that no longer are supported for competitive play. Mm. So they just don't produce them. And they, if you have them, they don't let you use them in a competitive match, which kind of sucks These were a lot of flavorful models.
Yeah, it really unfortunately pulls down, I think, display boards a little bit when people are trying to show off their armies, because these were some incredibly cool units. So it is what it is. All right, but that's enough kind of side characters or people who are in Legends. Let's talk about someone who does have a model. Varro Tigerius.
I'm going with Tiggy.
I've always called him Tiggy, so I'm going to keep calling him Tiggy. And I would actually argue the current Primaris model for him rarely is maybe the best. The second edition one was cool. I had all three of these at one point. I didn't love the fourth edition because of the pose, but I'm welcome.
Because he was doing the buddy Jesus.
Yeah. Buddy Christ Tiggy was my least favorite of the Tiggies. But Tiggy has some serious lore. Born on McCreg, Tigerius showed rampant psychic powers early on, to the point where while he was in the trials to become a space marine, he was accused of cheating. And it was then that they realized, oh no, he's just a super powerful psyker. And so they moved him out of that group over into the future librarian group.
Also, they said that in the tiers themselves, there wasn't a tier for him. He's next level psyker.
Yeah, and the main thing about him is because he has a very unique ability. He has precognition. Tiggy can see the future. He's one of, and this is a rare thing in all psychers, by the way.
And it's super cool because Tiggy's powers on the table matches lore, which is really nice because his precog.
Depends on the edition.
Yeah, I mean, recent editions where he got to give something -1 to hit because of his precog. He was saying, this is going to happen. We need to move.
Yeah.
I
like it. I'm just torn on Tigerius. I'm just going to jump ahead of it. Is the most powerful psyker maybe in the Imperium. And he gives what? +1 to hit? I mean, he was borderline God, because you put him on the board. This was 9th edition and maybe 8th edition as well. He had a +1 to all of his psychic powers, which he had three of, and he could deny your ability to use powers at a +1, and he could re-roll that test.
Yeah, he was shutting stuff down.
It was awesome. He was an auto-include in my Ultramarines for almost, actually, I think every time.
Still had the -1 thing in addition to that.
He did, but my point is, I'm trying to think of, I may have played with him in almost every game. I loved having him and Gilliman around each other. It was just more funny. But anyway, like all Ultramarine characters, when Tiggy gets a write-up by GW, it is hilariously overpowered. And a couple of these are great. So 5th Company are engaged with Forces of Chaos, and their 5th Company are fighting a cabal of 7 sorcerers. So Tiggy and the 5th Company fight their way to the sorcerers, and a big psychic battle commences, which every time they write this, I think of the South Park thing where Cartman pretends to be a psychic. Sorry, it just unfortunately does kind of ruin it. But this psychic battle is not that long, though, because the 7 sorcerers start casting their spells, and Tigerius just kills all 7 of them at the exact same time with his mind. And just looks around and goes, all right.
What? I thought this was a serious threat. Is there another threat that I should be worried about here? Because I took care of this one, but I thought there was a real threat.
Does anyone have a sandwich? Because I'm kind of hungry. Anyway, but that's nothing. That story is cute. Now we're going to do the... Man, this one's hilarious. All right. End of M41. Ultramar is invaded by Forces of Chaos. This is not the time they get invaded by Nurgle, or the time that they get invaded by... It's just, this is all Ultramar does, is get invaded, which is why the Ultramars are such good soldiers, because they're always fighting.
Everything. Chaos, Tyranids.
It's nonstop. Ultramar is kind of amazing when you think about it, in that it's the most successful segment in the Imperium outside of maybe Terra, and it is under attack, I don't know, every 6 weeks by a galaxy-destroying force. And every 4 weeks, they defeat them and then wait 2 weeks, rebuild, and go again. But near the end of M41, Ultramar is invaded. This time, it's a demon prince named M'Kar the Reborn, and forces that are called the Bloodborn. M'Kar was originally a dark apostle within the Word Bearers, and he killed enough people during the underground wars of Koth, by the way, millions of people, that the Chaos Gods elevated him to demonhood.
Which also, by the way, if you don't remember Koth, everybody, it's where everyone went for 7 years to level up. So if you're playing a video game, you went there and you grinded out your levels and then you played the game.
Exactly. And so he does not care much for the Ultramarines. So he's leading this massive invasion and he's there to destroy them once and for all. Spoiler alert, he doesn't. Now, during the battle, the Chaos forces are unleashing this like onslaught of psychic powers on this world called Talasar. It's an Imperial world in the middle of the Ultramar subsector. Tiggy is there, so is Khalgar. And Tiggy is using his psychic powers to beat back these endless waves of demons, but for weeks, just like the Emperor's power on the Siege of Terra. But over time, he starts running out of energy. And eventually, Tiggy has to don on the blue plot armor of amazingness. So
He did it twice.
So as his barrier falls.
Yeah. It's so funny because, come on now, he does the Emperor in Revenge of the Sith, which is, oh, I've got no power. I'm so tired. I can't possibly do anything. And then he just punches out a supernova and then they carry him off.
This is hilarious. His fortress is falling. Sorry, his force field is failing. It finally fails. All the demons launch forward. The Ultramarines are exposed because they're outside. They were relying on this force field. And Tiggy looks at this going and summons all of his remaining power and does a like psychic supernova that just demolishes the Chaos forces there, allowing the Ultramarines to grab everybody, including him, and bring them inside. But oh no, the plot armor has to thicken up. So Tiggy falls into a coma while this happens. And he's just lying in the infirmary, unconscious. Fast forward, I don't know, 6 hours. It's hard to tell. M'Kar, the demon prince, arrives.
His coma was more like a nap because he was tired.
But they're lying to them.
After lying to him, going, I've got no more power at all, except for this supernova. Kaboom! Yeah. You're like, what?
And I love this so much because then M'Kar, the demon prince, shows up and starts ripping through the keep. And this is in the book, by the way. Talgar is now engaged with M'Kar himself. M'Kar is going to kill Khalgar, at which point Tiggy wakes up from his coma. But he's too weak to move his arms and legs.
Okay, so I love your reference, but if you don't mention that they're weakened at Bernie's him, I mean, they didn't.
No, because Bernie was dead. That's the difference.
This is sorry.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Wesley from, from Princess Bride.
He's lying in bed and just says, take me to the battle. And a dozen humans in the infirmary pick him up and carry him to the battlefront like Wesley at the gate to Humperdinck's castle. And there, Tiggy is just being held up and unleashes an even larger psychic supernova from his brain that drives M'Kar back, allowing them to rally. And actually, Khalgar ends up killing M'Kar as a result of this. And this is, I only see this as a scene in Princess Bride. That's the only way I can possibly see this.
I might be.
Yeah.
Vomit his ass.
Another key part of Tiggy, though, in the lore, is that Tiggy is the person who convinced Khalgar to let Kahl and the Eldar in to perform the ritual on Gilliman. Khalgar is looking at Kahl, who he has never met before, and he's with a bunch of Eldar, and they're saying, hey, we want to go poke Gilliman while he's unconscious to make him alive. And Khalgar's like, yeah, you're not going in there. Right. That's not there.
And then he looks over at Tiggy, and Tiggy's pretty excited, by the way, of getting the Primarch back, and Khalgar knows that Tigerius has precog abilities. Mm-hmm. And he says, we need to let this happen.
And that's so
that's a big thing. That's so much respect, though. He just says, we need to let this. And Khalgar went, all right. Well, you know what? He's not going to let something terrible happen. Also, he sees the future, so it'd be really cool.
Now, another thing on Tiggy is kind of weird is he's now a Primaris Marine. I don't know why. Just is. Crossed the Rubicon. Did he do it over a long weekend? Maybe. I have no idea. But anyway. From Tiggy, we're going to move over onto another character who does have a model, Sicarius.
We'll be right back after a quick break.
You know that feeling when your day finally slows down and you just want to relax, unplug, and feel good? That's where Mood.com comes in. They're changing the game, delivering legal THC products right to your door, no shady dealers, and absolutely no medical card required, just good vibes and better sleep, shipped straight from their farm to your couch. From delicious THC gummies, smooth vape pens, to premium THC flower, Mood has it all. And everything's federally legal under the 2018 Farm Bill. Yeah, this isn't some loophole. It's the real deal. Head to Mood.com and use code FIRST20 for 20% off your first order. That's MOOD.com. Find your mood.
Sicarius is so much better in the lore than he is in the tabletop.
Light years better.
I actually don't think I've ever seen him on the tabletop.
Well, because
I'm not sure.
Sicarius would have to have a 2-up rerollable invuln. He's got such thick plot.
I cannot think of a time I've seen someone playing him.
People are going to be just mad. Sicarius people are going to be mad. I've seen it.
Yeah.
He's got the reactive move.
Yeah. Yeah. The rules are okay now, but they're not great because he also gives him assault, but you're only going to put him with guys who have pistols. So who cares?
Reactive move is good.
Anyway. All right. So born on Talasar, which is the world we just talked about, well before this invasion, by the way, Sicarius plot armor came on at a young age. So it's written at 4 years old.
I was just about to say, there's young age and then there's 4 years old age. Yeah. Come on, John.
At 4 years old, he is listed as being able to wrestle, sword fight, and shoot, quote, to the satisfaction of his masters. Now, as a parent, I can be honest with you, you grade your kids on a wide curve. So when they're saying, like, to the satisfaction, I'm pretty easily satisfied with some behaviors of my 4-year-old when it comes to sports. Like, you know, didn't fall down when kicking soccer ball was kind of the grade I was on. But the way this is written, it sounds more like Sicarius was on par with Inigo Montoya left-handed, you know, with his sword play at 4 years old. Once he joins the Ultramarines, he gets promoted fast. Within a few centuries, he's captain of the second company. Second company, so the way these companies work, it's in order. So you have the chapter master, then you have captain of first company, and then captain of second company in order of who's in charge in a room. So he is third in charge because Gilliman's not alive yet. He also then earns the title Master of the Watch, meaning it was his job to keep watch over Ultramar, keep it safe. He wasn't the fourth company or the protectors of Ultramar, but the second one also have to make sure that there's no issues with Ultramar.
He's also a little bit testy, I might say.
Yeah, he's kind of a dick. Sicarius is really not an Ultramarine in the sense we go to describe when we think of an Ultramarine. He's more of a blend between a Space Wolf and a Dark Angel in that he revels in combat like a Space Wolf was, but he's not brash the way they are, but he's hyper aggressive. And he's not as reserved as a Dark Angel, but he is that same level of, if I'm coming to kill you, I'm coming to kill you. Like, I'm not going to say a lot of words, and we're going to do this. So he falls this kind of like middle ground, which technically makes him one of the best soldiers in the galaxy. Because if you could mix a Space Wolf with a Dark Angel for combat, it's kind of a win. He's basically the Ultramarine Sigismund. In fact, here, fun story on that.
Champion him up, so...
Yeah, so a couple of different times he's taken on the mantle of champion for the Ultramarines. And so champion means that he's their key fighter. One of these stints, they're on McCreg, and an Inquisitor arrives. And the Inquisitor is there to accuse Tiggy of heresy. And in front of Kalgar and the entire Legion,
he gives his sales pitch of how evil Slakers are and Tiggy's tainted by the great enemy. And they let him go. And then Kalgar effectively gives Sicarius the nod. And Sicarius just walks down and just kind of goes, points at the circle, I'm assuming they have in the middle of the room, and says, too much talky-talky, more punchy-punchy. Let's do this.
And the Inquisitor's all excited when this happens. Because the Inquisitor's like, excellent, I knew they'd do this. So he brought with him a champion. And the champion is what's called a Chrono Gladiator, which is an Admech-created super dueling, I mean, we're gonna call it human machine, human and heavy air quotes.
Yeah, I was like, about to say, like
3 bits left.
It is General Grievous levels of human.
Exactly. This is General Grievous. That's what he brought with him. Sicarius looks the robot up and down and just goes, all right, and spends the next few hours playing with it in combat. Like, they talk about the robot attacks and he just trips it to the ground, and then he just punches one of its pieces of armor, basically
I was going to say, he takes a little piece of him off each time, though.
Yeah, so for a couple hours, he slowly chips this thing down, but not because it's a protracted battle and he's in danger. No, he could have killed it in minute 4. He just thought this would be funnier. And he just sits there and toys with this thing until it's lying in a pool on the ground and dying from exhaustion and everything else.
Let's talk about the excellent decision the Inquisitor made, because after that's lying in a heap on the ground, the Inquisitor decides, I'm not going to abide by this trial by combat because I'm sad, and I'm going to take out my pistol and show these guys who's boss. I don't really know what he was thinking. There were so many characters from the Ultra Breeds in this place.
Well, I can tell you what he was thinking. Someone at GW writing this had just watched Star Wars Episode 4, because that's what happens here. He goes to pull his pistol out, and his hand and pistol are lying on the ground. Sicarius walks over and stomps on the pistol, and the Inquisitor and his retinue, have to flee.
Yeah, because you're like, what? You wonder if they're on the ship on the way back going, all right, boss, how did you think that was going to play out? Let's review this, bro.
Let's check the notes. Now, Sicarius in single is pretty good. The question around him, and it still is, that is he a good leader or not? And the reason why that's a question is that there's been a few incidents with him as a leader. One of them was back in Blackreach, which I should have mentioned earlier. Blackreach had a box set, and for Orc players, it's one of the best box sets ever released.
Best box set, period, though. It's got It might be the best box set. It's got wild value. There.
Yeah, it's Blackreach.
It's, I mean, it's top five for sure.
I think half of my Coptas come from that box.
It just has a ton of models in it for the price.
That was a great one. But as we covered before, 855 M41, he's leading second company against the war boss Zanzag. And Zanzag has been discovered. He is victorious. He's the one that actually leads in after fighting the submarine base. The problem is that he took 100 space marines to go fight 10,000 orcs. And during this, they literally run out of ammo and have to start killing the orcs with knives and chainswords. They are successful, but everyone started asking, like, well, why? Why did you deploy down with such incredible odds against you? Just orbital bombardment, dude.
Also, you know how many are there. Bring enough bring at least one bullet for each guy. How about that?
Yeah. Yeah. And so there's a lot of questions about, is he too brash of a leader? Is that, and I think they're kind of right, if I'm being honest. His next big one happens in 947. And in 947, he's with the second company on Damnos. Damnos is fighting here what is an unknown to the Space Marines race of the Necrons. And they're completely unprepared for this battle. They get wrecked. And Sicarius himself gets mortally wounded in this battle. The Ultramarines are able to blow one of the planets up, because I guess there was a bad reactor somewhere, because they probably fired a torpedo down the exhaust port no wider than a Womp Rat. It's GW writing. But it's a catastrophic loss. And it's a big knock on Sicarius, because he failed. Now, he does get a chance to redeem himself, though, because luckily he has a dream while unconscious.
A vision quest. He was in the spirit world.
He was in a coma, and he had a vision of the Necrons he just fought rising up and killing them. And it's a good thing he has this, because the AdMech hadn't told anybody about the Necrons yet, namely the fact that they reanimate. And so he, and it grabs a few other people, burst into the storage room where they'd kept some of the dead Necrons that they'd stolen for study, to discover a bunch of standing Necrons holding Gauss weapons, and luckily kill them all before this group of Necrons would have probably blown the ship up, because they would have, you know, popped a hole in it somewhere and caused some problems.
Also, GW has a habit of saying mortal wounds from people that pop up instantaneously. I do the Arnold the Last Action Hero, mortal wound, that's just a stretch. What are you talking about?
But let's go with Sicarius going a little over the top, because I like the over the top story. Fast forward 52 years. We're in 999 of M41. Necrons are now a known entity. The Lords of Terra order that the planet Damnos and the Necrons there have to be destroyed. It is not good for Imperial morale to have a loss. And the Ultramarines don't lose. So Khalgar agrees and orders the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 5th, and 6th companies all to Damnos. They leave the 4th behind because the 4th only defends Ultramar, for the record. Otherwise, I would have said 1 through 6.
I was going to say, everyone.
Everyone except the guys who can't go. Yeah.
Hey.
They start fighting.
All I'm saying is I had a chance to do Gary Oldman from The Professional, so I had to throw it in there.
From Leon.
Leon, The Professional. Full title.
Just fine. They get there, and the plot armor just starts to thicken pretty quick. So as they arrive, this is now a fully awakened Tomb World. As they're fighting the Necrons, and it starts, as always, going well, and it stops going well because the Necrons pull out a Tesseract vault with a C-10 inside of it, and that thing starts causing some problems. In addition, the Kryptek battle logic is always one step ahead of Khalgar. And defeat is, of course, in sight. So Khalgar realizes the only thing he can do to an enemy so attuned with logic was to do something illogical. Someone at GW was watching Star Trek.
Just want to say,
yeah.
Is Picard here running this battle?
Yeah. So Khalgar, cool story, himself jumps onto a Gauss pylon, which had awesome rules in 7th and 8th edition. It's very much so in Legends now. Those things, if you brought a knight and someone brought a Gauss pylon, you just went, oh, so I'm losing this game? Yeah.
Did shoot in a straight line.
Yeah. And would auto kill a knight. It was cool. So anyway, he grabs the Gauss pylon by hand and just turns it until the Gauss pylon shoots a Tesseract vault, blowing it up and freeing the C-10.
Which also, in case you haven't listened to our Necron cast, the old Catan, whatever, are not huge fans of the Necrons. And they are all so shackled. They're being used as either weapons and batteries or just enslaved, period. So when this guy gets freed, he goes, oh, yeah, I've got some stuff I'd like to talk about.
Yeah, I'm going to have a chat with all of you guys, point the Necrons, right now. So this turns a tide for the Ultramarines because this fragment of a star god is roaming around the battlefront, mostly targeting the Necrons. However, it's only mostly. He's still a star god who doesn't really like anything living and starts also fighting the Ultramarines. This comes to a head because Sicarius is dealing with some flayed ones when the C-10 appears basically near him. And the C-10 starts lashing out at Sicarius and the Necrons. Sicarius, again, this is what they wrote, so I'm going to tell you. While ramming his sword into one of the flayed ones, reaches down to his belt and pulls a vortex grenade off his belt.
I've got multiple things on this.
Yeah.
Why does he have a vortex grenade? These are unbelievably rare. Well,
they do cover that. Someone, it was a friend of his, was in the Death Watch and gave it to him before the battle. But still, he's got a vortex grenade.
Just he does ready to go, like, and then he sky hooks it.
I assume they don't write it, but I assume he primes it with his, pulls the pin out with his teeth type thing. Yeah. And then just overhead lobs it into the breadbasket of the sea.
You gotta say skyhook. Saying Kareem, he definitely Kareems it. He puts the skyhook right into the Catan.
What, yells Kobe while doing it?
Yeah, 100%. And then
hits the C-10 of the breadbasket, sucking it into the Imiteer and removing it from existence. But that's not the end of Sicarius. The next one.
There's more. Yeah,
there's always more. And I actually do enjoy this one again. So going back to the invasion of Ultramar by Emkar and the Bloodborne, Sicarius is there. Now, he's not on Talasar with Khalgar and Tigerius. He was given something else to do. He had to go to Espendor, which is a forest world, and it's also a cardinal world. So the Ecclesiarchy cares about it a lot. Here, we've got this pirate leader named Karja Salambar. And she's using her fleet to disrupt the flow of supplies all around Ultramar, hampering the defensive efforts. So, blah, 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 intrigue, blah, 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 almost find her, because she's hard to find. But Sicarius is a really good hunter. And then they finally meet. And this story is epic because it's funny. Salambar's at least part Eldar. We don't know how much, but she is a Corsair. But she's an Eldar infused with the powers of chaos. So she's in a duel with Sakaris, and no matter what Sakaris does, he can't hit her until he lets her, we don't really know, stab him in one of his hearts.
You know what? I need to make this reference. It was a movie and you haven't seen it. He does a Rob Roy.
I've seen Rob Roy. It's still not good. It's not a good movie.
It's the end scene, though, where he can't beat him and he just goes, all right, screw it, and just grabs the sword and obliterates himself so he can stab him as he's getting obliterated, which is exactly what Sakaris does.
It's got a 73 on Rotten Tomatoes. I guess it's not that bad, but it is. And I do love, you give me a movie with Liam Neeson and Tim Roth, I'm interested. Oh, and Brian Cox. I'm interested. Just
it's worth it. Somebody's going to watch this and go, I see your movie, Brad. It was shit.
But yeah, so he gets stabbed. He then grabs her because, you made the wrong movie reference. Let's do the proper, because she stabs him. He grabs her arm and holds her in place while one of his sergeants runs her through with the chapter banner, with the pole, a la the movie The Patriot, which, for the record, I saw that movie in the theater and I laughed out loud when he stabs the guy with the American flag, because it's one of the dumbest things I think I've seen in cinema. But let's do one more Sakaris, because Sakaris is not done yet. Sakaris maybe has some of the most active plot armor in current 40K for a non-major character. I guess he's a major character. It's hard to tell how important he is, but he's just everywhere. Because later, he's with Gilliman at the Resurrection, and he joins Gilliman on the trip back to Terra. And he's there with Gilliman fighting on Luna, doing all this stuff. And eventually, Gilliman is back on Terra and says, look, I can't leave Terra, but I need you to go back to Ultramar and keep it safe. So Sakaris departs. Unfortunately, while going back to McCraig, there's this massive, like really kind of sudden and small area warp storm. And the last message coming from Sakaris' ship is, they have breached the hull, they are here. And 5 years go by. And it's assumed that Sakaris is dead. Another captain gets promoted up to second company, all this stuff. But Sakaris ain't going out like that. So for 5 years, Sakaris and actually a bunch of fellow Marines are in this ship fighting the Denzians of the warp, one after another, trying to fight their way back to the bridge. They eventually get back to the bridge and they translate back into the Materium. This part's stupid because they find themselves in the middle of nowhere.
They do a Star Trek. What was the movie where they went back in time?
Let's find out. Is it two? Let's do Star Trek movies.
So Khan was two.
Voyage Home. It is four. It's four. It's Voyage Home. Yeah. That's with the whales.
The whales. They go back and save the whales.
They go back in time by going around the sun. Anyway. So they emerge from the warp and they're above a human planet. And the human planet is undiscovered by the Imperium. It's called a medieval world because it's still using primitive technology. You following? The people, the plot twists on this are like an M. Night Shyamalan movie written by a 14-year-old, because it is just one after another after another. So they get down to the world and they find out that the humans there are fighting a bunch of feral orcs, not full-blown orcs, feral orcs, who are also on the planet.
All right. To be inconspicuous, Sakaris and his men go down and claim to be knights of the lands of McCraig. They are Marines, man. They're doing the Steve Buscemi, hello, fellow children. What are you talking about, man?
They're at least 50% bigger than everyone else on this planet. They're
covered in cybernetics.
Yeah. And they're claiming not that they're from another planet, that they're from this other part of the planet that these people just didn't know was there.
But yeah. My girlfriend's from another school. You wouldn't know her.
That's. But by the way, we're not done with a plot twist, because while they're there, they also realize that the rulers of the main city on the planet are pawns for the Necrons because they've been implanted with mind shackle scarabs. Is that complex enough for you? Because we're not done yet. The next bit is even more complicated because there's a Necron tomb under that city. So Sicarius and his men.
I was saying, go in order. So they kill the orcs. They go back and also don't tell anybody why they're doing this, but they start just murdering people in the city, which is what they think. They just see these guys go, whoo, real tired from killing orcs. And they just start murdering people, the populace of the city. Now they are infected with mind shackle scarabs. They don't tell anybody about this or don't even try to tell anybody about this. They just start hacking people down.
Yep. And then they find this secret trap door, I guess, that goes down to the Necron tomb. They then go down that. And while doing that, there's a Seatan shard there as well that they also destroy.
Fairly easily, by the way. This was one of the ones where you're just like, hey, man, aren't these like unstoppable? And you're like, unless I got a couple of my buddies who are dressed up as knights.
And we press the off button. Oh, okay. Fair enough. So after all this, they go back up to their ship, which, whatever, and go back to McCreg. They get back there, and Sicarius, actually, this is the sad part of the story, is kind of a broken man. He gets back there. He's got survivor's guilt. This is his first time to kind of rest. And for the last 5 years, he's been in nonstop combat. Almost everyone he knows is dead. He's come back to McCreg. There's a different person in charge of his chapter.
I would say his job. Yeah.
Yeah, his job. And he has no purpose. Luckily, Gilliman has a plan, because Gilliman always has a plan, if we're being honest. And Gilliman realizes that there's no one in the Ultramarines more trustworthy and more honorable than Sicarius. So Gilliman promotes him to be the head of the Victrix Guard, his personal bodyguard for him and any other chapter masters. Him and Khalgar roll around with these guys. Sicarius now has a new purpose, and it's allowing him to also appear, by the way, in every Ultramarine book.
Every major combat he is in now.
Yeah, he's at Baal, he's at the Plague Wars, Mesmok, nonstop. Everything Ultramarines do, Sicarius is there. And his rules in 10th edition are fine. Fine.
I love fine.
It's fine. But from there, let's jump over to another one. Uriel Ventress. Now,
rules on the table. Such good rules that they nerfed him. You sons of bitches.
He was good. I'll be honest.
He's still fine. He made it. The fact that I can't do deep striking centurions makes me sad.
Yeah, that was a stupid rule.
That was an awesome rule.
That was brutal. Yeah, we learned that in the end of 8th edition. Why would you bring that back?
Because it's awesome. I think you meant to say it was an awesome rule, and why wouldn't we bring it back? Anyway. I, of course, used that rule in both 8th and 10th when I was able to.
Yeah. So Ventress is born on Kalf, post the wars, but in the underground farms. This is a world whose son, by the way, was wrecked by the word bearers. So you have to live underground.
You could probably get a tan super fast, though.
Well, no, you don't get a tan. You just get skin cancer. It's not really the same.
That's still a tan. I didn't say there wouldn't be bonus things. I said you could get a tan.
Fair enough. So, like all Ultramarine heroes, or really any Space Marine hero, he shows exceptionalism at an early age. He's promoted quickly and attains numerous successes and accolades. But the big moment for Uriel is when he joins the Death Watch. It's interesting that none of his actions, this is all they say, oh, he did a lot of good things and he joined the Death Watch. And then in the Death Watch, he served with them and learned a lot about aliens, namely Tyranids.
Primarily Tyranids.
Yeah, but then he comes back to the Ultramarines and Uriel is ascended to captainhood. And his first main mission is on a world called Pavonis. And Pavonis had failed to meet its tithe requirements and thus needed a talking to. This is all from the book The Nightbringer, which is released in 2002. So it's older than some of our listeners. But GW writing this era was really good, but it was pretty heavy-handed on plot twists. So I'm going to keep the book at a high level because despite the age of this book, it's one I do recommend you read. So I don't want to kill you all of it. But Ventress discovers the world is corrupted by greed. There's Drukhari, who are active, although not raiding, but they're active there, and a slumbering Seatan called the Nightbringer. This is the book that actually brought the Nightbringer into the game. Ventress saves the world, but the Nightbringer escapes. And the act of seeing a billion-year-old god messes Bill's mind up a little bit. And he actually loses some confidence in some of his abilities. Now, fast forward a few years, because that's going to kind of rack him for a while. Tyranids are invading, and there's a tendril of the Hive Fleet behemoth that's bearing down the world of Tarsis, the Ultramar region. Tarsis, for whatever reason, is marked by the Ultramarines and by the Imperium as a world that cannot fall. So Ventress is tasked with saving it and repelling the Tyranid invasion. Unfortunately, due to conflicts with the Inquisition and the adaptability of the Hive Mind, Behemoth is on the verge of taking the world and the sector.
And yeah, but Ventress does, which is possibly the coolest thing I've seen. He captures a Lictor, which is unheard of.
Yeah, if you played Space Marine 2, you realize Lictors kind of come out of nowhere. So how do you find a Lictor? Although I think the Catachans were able to find them. I think in the lore, Catachans can
They've done it a couple. We talked about one of my favorite Lictors, the one that couldn't be seen even when they had it in the cell. They're like, it doesn't show up on scans. Oh, it's in there. Don't go
in. Oh, it's in there. Yeah, don't open the door. Just a big sign, do not open. Bad thing inside. But they capture a Lictor, and they're able to use the Lictors to create a poison that will work on the Tyranids. The problem is the only way to deploy the poison is to go to the Tyranid hive ship and inject it directly into the Norn Queen. The Norn Queen is what makes the Tyranids. So if you inject it in the Norn Queen, it'll spread to the entire populace. Now, the issue, obviously, is that this is almost a suicide mission. And if it doesn't work, the sector will fall. So the Death Watch volunteer say, we've got this. But Ventress knows how important this mission is. And he does something that you're not supposed to do. He cedes command of his Ultramarines and leaves them to go lead this Death Watch assault. It is successful. He saves the sector.
There's a huge but on that. You can't secede command of your legion. It's not, especially in the Ultramarines, they're all about the chain of command and everything else. And they immediately take basically court-martial him.
Yep. While being court-martialed, Khalgar, not directly, but through a proxy, reaches out to him and says, do not fight this. Accept your punishment. Do not fight it. It's bad for Legion. So Uriel does. He and his second, a guy named Pausanias, are sentenced to what's called a death oath. And a death oath is when they give you just this monumental task that you either have to achieve or die trying to achieve. Same with Sisters Repentia. Same concept. And they're told, Tiggy had a dream. You have to go find this thing called the Demon Kulaba, which sounds like a very spicy meal. The Demon Kulaba is something I would go to a Mexican restaurant. It would definitely come in a molcajete, and it's just so hot, and it's made for white people who want a challenge. So as they travel into the warp, the Geller field fails, and they're kidnapped by a demon engine. And there, Uriel learns of this plot by the Iron Warriors to make new Iron Warriors. Because one of the challenges Chaos has is they can't make new Chaos. They don't have gene seeds. They can capture some here and there, but they don't have recruits. So the Iron Warriors basically figure out a way to clone from using Chaos powers. GW, by the way, does find a lot of ways around the whole, there's a limited number of Chaos Marines. There's always, every Legion has some workaround.
Oh, please summon, they demon infuse. Yeah.
But just saying, technically it's that. Uriel and Pausanias end up blowing up this demon Kulaba like they're supposed to and getting back into the Materium.
They destroy the way that they were going to do all that stuff too. Blow up the lab.
Yeah, I don't want to ruin the book. It's actually a good book. The Uriel books are very popular, so go ahead and read them. There's three of them. They're very good. But they pop back into the Materium, and the Grey Knights are basically waiting for them and going, yeah, you're coming with us. And they spend, I forget how much time with the Grey Knights being tested. And the Grey Knights actually come out and say, no, they are pure souls. You are free to go back to the Ultramarines. The next big thing for Uriel is back to the invasion of Ultramar with Emkar. Uriel plays this most Ultramarine role ever. So in the warp, Uriel discovered the true name of Emkar, which is Moloch Kartho.
I love everything about this. It's fine. It's actually makes sense in the writing, but when you have to say it out loud, it makes no sense because it's like somebody in the warp just handed him an envelope from a guy in a trench coat and a hat and was like, do with this one. Exactly.
Like, you might need this later.
I don't even know this guy.
And also, Uriel randomly goes tomb raiding, by the way, to an Ultramarine captain named Ventanus. By the way, this feels like it should have been a bigger deal. Ventanus found a sword. He stabbed the demon Samus with it and killed it and banished it back and then just kept it.
Wandered away. No one even asked about it. They're like, all right.
Whatever. So Ventress goes to his tomb and grabs that blade. So in the pivotal battle where, as I said before, Tiggy reaches out, knocks Emkar backwards. As that happens, this is the whole scene. So Emkar is about to kill Khalgar. Tiggy, being held up by 12 men, just blinks his eyes twice and unleashes a sting, knocks Emkar back. As that happened, Uriel jumps into the fray and yells the demon's true name, which freezes Emkar in place. And then as Khalgar leaps through the air, he throws Khalgar the knife and Khalgar stabs Emkar in the throat.
Well, I'm going to go over a couple things. One, everybody knows that if you have a paralyzed opponent, you automatically crit it. Two, yep. When he threw the dagger, there's a 100% chance that it was in slow motion. So yes. That's just what that goes without saying, I feel.
Oh, and with explosions behind it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's huge rules. Explosions behind in
there
slow-mo.
There are rules. Yeah, there are rules to this world. But because it's a demon blade and because he said his true name, Emkar actually is destroyed. He's not banished back to the warp. He ceases to exist.
The effect of summon his true being to this plane.
Yeah. And now he has, and so now Uriel's in the game. Uriel's still available in the game. His model does look cool with his green cape. I owned that one too.
He also bangs.
Yeah. But we've covered a lot of Ultramarine characters, and we have to save what I think is the most important for last. If he's not number one in your heart, it's because your soul is black as coal. The one, the only, Antaro Kronos. Maybe the greatest model GW ever made.
You're never even going to know what the hell this is. His model that you...
Every Ultramarine player is losing their mind right now. Because, yes, the Kronos model.
Kronos has two models because his rules are he buffs up a tank. They have a list of tanks he can be assigned to. And his model was a little...
The hatch.
Yeah. A hatch with his head sticking out. Yeah,
you put him in, and he fit perfectly. So you take the hatch off, the top hatch off, and you put Kronos on. And then he had a second model where he had a red helmet on, and he would stand outside because the same way Canis Rex couldn't do it, if you kill the tank he's in, he just gets out of the tank. And it's like, oh, that was awkward. That's his thing. Yeah, all he did was gave your tank ballistic skill of 2, but it wouldn't degrade, which was nice.
Is a big deal.
Yeah, you could, in theory, put him in a Rhino, but every time I put him in my Land Raider Crusader for 40 shots hitting on 2s. Oh, yeah, he's actually another interesting guy. I just love the model. He was the master armorer for the Ultramarines. He's considered the greatest tank commander of the Ultramarines due to both tactical acumen, but also his ability to jury-rig vehicles together. Like their stories really aren't that great. It's, oh, he was driving around a tank, and the tank took a lot of damage and kept firing. And at the end of the battle, the Admech looked at the tank and went, we don't know how this thing is still functioning. And Kronos just kind of gets out of it and walks away.
I'm assuming he walks away with his mullet because he's definitely MacGyver.
Oh, yeah, 100%. They're always looking like, how did this even work? He's like, I don't know. Why can't you guys figure this stuff out? That's about it. Obviously, we haven't touched on Khalgar. So we're going to close this out but with Khalgar. Khalgar's tricky, though, honestly, from a lore standpoint. And the reason he's tricky is Khalgar... he's got some OP stuff, and we're going to cover that. He's just so prevalent everywhere, and he's written so perfectly. I actually find him less interesting than some of the other ones.
He is rocking the Gauntlets of Ultramar, which are comically large power fists.
Yes, with guns underneath them. Yes. So, yeah, it's so Khalgar's, and his writing also is tricky because there's a lot of new stuff on him. So let's just kind of get through this the best we can. And we're going to miss some stuff on Khalgar, but I'm going to cover the stuff that I think is most entertaining for the listeners. So GW has written Khalgar. He's just kind of always being there. Because if there's any, Khalgar is present in the third edition codex for sure. It might even be in the second edition codex for Space Marines. He has always been there. So there's not like this novels around him. He's just always been around. And he's got some great stories. But his origin story is the newest of the stories and is probably the craziest of all of them.
Oh, because 1,000% fully whacked his origin. It's crazy.
All right. So he has two origin stories. One of them was written in a white dwarf in 1986. And then the next one was in a graphic novel or comic in 2020. So there's a gap. But anyway, we'll do the graphic novel one because it's more funny. Khalgar is not Khalgar. That's the great thing there. His real name is Tekishin, Tekatan, We'll go with
Takatan. Thulium Takatan.
Takatan. Kalgar's dead. So, born on the ward of Thulium, Takatan.
World of Nova Thulium.
Nova Thulium, sorry. So, Takatan is a serf for the House of Kalgar. But, because GW writes stuff weird, he hung out with the heir to the Kalgar name. So, he's a serf, aka peasant, working the land. And he was just best friends with the prince. I've seen those Disney movies. They're not good. Anyway.
Pathfinder Wrath of the Righteous did this better. We continue.
Yeah. But he and Kalgar both wanted to become Ultramarines one day. And a common thing on planets is you actually practice and train the youth before they try to become a Space Marine. And on recruiting worlds, this is usually done by a Space Marine. On guard worlds like the Cadia and Krieg, they do this. Voidborn do this. Everyone trains their youth to become what the world wants to produce. Takatan and Kalgar join a group of aspirants under this guy named Crixus. C-R-I-X-U-S. So I'm going with Crixus, who was a failed neophyte of the Ultramarines. If you can't see the foreshadow, I don't know how. And he's super upset about failing about to be an Ultramarine and ends up becoming a cultist for Khorne. So one day, Takatan and Kalgar discover Crixus and all of the other aspirants are doing Khorne rituals. So a fight breaks out. And during this, Crixus kills Kalgar. And Takatan kills basically all the other aspirants because Takatan's the better fighter than real Kalgar was. But Takatan is then cornered by Crixus. And as Crixus is about to kill him, this Sergeant Arta of the Ultramarines arrives and just shoots him through the head.
Like casually, looks, by the way.
Yeah, pretty much like, all right. Well,
yeah, that was about this all about.
This is why you failed in neophyte training, because you probably should see this coming. But anyway, Sergeant Arta looks around and just sees Tacitus is standing with like dozens of dead Chaos cultists around him and goes, well, yeah, I think you made the cut, buddy. Come on, join the Ultramarines. But Takatan, for whatever reason, decides he wants to honor his friend and takes on the noble name of Kalgar. He was a serf.
I'm just under saying, one, he gets to be a noble. Two, if your name was Eugene Burt and you could be Ultra Nova Death Machine, you chose to be Ultra Nova Death Machine. Kalgar is so much
cooler. A Space Marine, your name means nothing.
I think that it means a lot. People know Marty as Kalgar pretty well.
Yeah, because he made a name for himself. It's not because it was Kalgar. It was easier to roll off the tongue. Anyway, there's actually no record or date of when Kalgar became a chapter master of the Ultramarines. I've searched codices, lexicanum, Reddit to no avail. If people can correct me on that, you can send me a link to it. I'd appreciate it. So Kalgar as a chapter master is written to be a near perfect commander. He's always calm under pressure. He can diagnose a situation, decide the best course of action, and then just act. And if you want a really good vision of that, Space Marine 2, when he just is on a Thunderhawk with hell breaking loose below him and just jumps off of it with his
Victor Star. Not a care in the world, by the way.
And just walks through them, just slaughtering stuff, and walks up to Titus and goes, so you sent me a telegram? I think, you want to let me know what's going on about this thing? Just couldn't care less. And I'll be honest, it gave me some goosebumps when I was watching, because I thought it was just this incredible depiction of what Kalgar is. Oh, speaking of, should we talk about the Gauntlets of Ultramar real quick?
I already said this. They are so wildly awesome looking. The best picture is from the Codex when he's sitting on the throne with the Gauntlets of Ultramar.
Yes, it's a fourth edition, I think. It's a fourth or fifth edition book.
So cool.
Yeah. And so no one knows where these things are from, by the way. Gilliman took them from a Chaos Champion during the Scouring Era. That's all that's known. They're assumed to be a relic from the Age of Technology because the AdMech can't figure them out, but they work pretty good. The only problem with them, my opinion, is that until Kalgar became a Primaris, they were a little oversized. They looked like the Hulk fists through most of the editions.
Basically using the Buster Sword as a little guy.
Yeah, and some of the early models, because Kalgar's had a model, obviously, in every edition. And some of the early ones, the fists were significantly larger than his head. But anyway, let's talk about Kalgar, though, becoming a Primaris, because this actually is important. Gilliman comes back. He's got these Primaris Marines, and there's an issue. All of the firstborn Marines are like, so that's our replacement? Nope. And there's a massive pushback amongst the Legion that they don't even want to serve with Primaris Marines. And Gilliman's kind of like, hey, we have a galactic war to win, so you need to. And he needs to not only just direct it, but he needs someone to step up and do it. So Kalgar steps up, and Kalgar offers himself up to say, well, just convert me to Primaris. And he's told that the odds are 60-40, not the good way, that he will die from this process.
Never tell me the odds. Yeah. So here's the thing. Every time you hear about converting over from Firstborn to Primaris, it's always, you're going to die for sure. It might work. And then every single character that's had the process done has been totally fine. Not even a blip. Just no big
work. Yeah, it works like a charm every time. And they do write that thanks to Kalgar, the process got better because they basically learned on him. But he becomes the first of the Firstborn to be converted, they call it crossing the Rubicon, to Primaris. That's all cute. Now I want to spend the last little bit of this cast talking about Kalgar and hilarious accomplishments. Now, Kalgar and Gilliman are involved in almost every battle now. Gilliman's in all the new ones, but before Gilliman came back, Kalgar was there for everything. Kalgar oftentimes, though, appears as a side character. He's there, he's leading the forces, but he's not as engaged. However, sometimes he is. And when Kalgar gets written by GW to be on a solo mission or doing something himself, it is insane, the stories.
What? Now, the Ultra Breeds have a fortress that's just every fight we've ever been in.
Yeah.
And Kalgar has 28 volumes of himself personally. The only person that has more is Bobby G.
I think the 28 volumes are more than double the guy in third place. So some of them are super over the top. And I just want to cover a few of those because this is why I like Ultramarines characters, because they get these massive over the top. So I don't know how this happens, but he's in a ship and then there's a sneak attack by the Night Lords and the ship crashes onto a planet where it's just him, I think, is all that's left. And Kalgar looks around, and the planet is full of primitive humans. So no bolters, no power, armor, nothing. But there's a few hundred non-primitive Night Lords landing on the planet with him in an attempt to kill him. So Kalgar goes full Endor here.
And apparently he's the Ewoks.
Yeah, he organizes the primitive humans, and he kills all of the Night Lords and escapes back to space. So Kalgar, and there's two ways to read this. You can read it like he got the humans to rally like the Ewoks of this, or how I read it, it's a repeat of the Lion and the Luther together, heavy air quotes, going and killing all of the beasts.
I still like the fact that Kalgar stood effectively in a doorway. It was the entrance, but it's a doorway.
Oh, the orc fight?
Yeah, there's not a single man that's eligible to fight. And Kalgar just sits there and just wrecks orcs for an Roadhouse entire style. Night. Yeah.
This is a great story. I forget the name of the battle, but yeah, there's a fortress. Kalgar is there and all of the defenders are just too weary to go on. The orcs keep coming. So Kalgar walks out and just stands in the main doorway and goes, who wants some of this? And spends an entire night killing orcs at the gate until the next day everyone had enough rest or they'd found the Red Bull supply and they counterattack and kill the orcs.
Hey, just told big guys in one line, little guys in another. Let's do this.
Mm-hmm. Now, another fun story. Kalgar and the Swarm Lord have a bit of a history. In the Battle of McCreg, the Swarm Lord almost kills Kalgar, runs him through, and he has to be saved by his Vitrix Guard.
Yeah, but then he has a total glow up 80s montage video because he fights him in round two and apparently full weapons and everything getting beat. He's like, I'm going to fight him somehow, by the way, in bare hands, even though he's in his power.
It does say bare hands. I checked it. The Codex does say this. So let's set the stage. Ikar 4, Ultramarines are fighting the Tyranids. The Swarm Lord appears. And the Swarm Lord is the greatest general in all of the Tyranids. Swarm Lord is a Primarch, or a Cryptech for Necrons. It's that good. And Kalgar knows that the only way to defeat the Tyranids here is to kill the Swarm Lord. And the Swarm Lord knows if it kills Kalgar, the Ultramarines are gone. So, of course, they end up in an epic 1v1 battle. But this isn't a novel's the problem. This isn't a codex. So it's not that drawn out. All we know is that with his bare hands, Khalgar kills a swarm lord.
So again, how does he have bare hands?
Yeah. I'm assuming they just meant to say, like, he didn't shoot him. He just punched him with his superpower fist, which would make sense.
Seems better.
10th edition, Khalgar could pull that off. Khalgar versus swarm lord in melee combat. I think Khalgar can kill the swarm lord. But let's say the best for last, because this is the dumbest of the things he pulls off. Ultramarines and Beeltan are at war over an artifact in the tomb of a former Ultramarine captain. They never explain why, by the way, what this artifact
they just
is.
Are.
Yeah. During the battle, the Beeltan deploy an Avatar of Kane, which, for the record, is when you take an Autarch, he takes a shard of the Avatar of Kane, turns into a giant made of lava carrying a fire sword. That's an Avatar of Kane. It is in between human and god. Khalgar looks up as this Avatar of Kane is ripping apart Ultramarines and throwing them all over and just goes, nope, not you ain't pulling that off again. And as the Avatar runs at him and swings his flame sword at him, with one hand, Khalgar grabs the sword and catches it, and with the other one, punches him through the chest out the other side, killing the Avatar of Kane. Which actually, again, 10th edition rules, he could kill the Avatar of Kane. I will say, like, rules-wise, this actually lines up. These ones are doable, but it's mostly because the Avatar of Kane and the Swarm Lord on the tabletop are nowhere near as good as they should be.
But
I think with Khalgar covered, we can probably call this an end to Ultramarines for now. They're going to come up in most all stories we cover as we cover any part of 40K lore. But we have somewhere else that we need to go. And Brad's going to get excited, as a lot of you are. We're preparing for this series of episodes, and then out of nowhere, GW dropped the Votann Codex. This is what we've been waiting for. We haven't done the Votann yet because off one codex, it's kind of hard to do a deep dive in the lore. Now that we have two codexes, I've actually been able to read through them pretty well. We have a novel and some White Dwarf. We're ready to cover the Votann. So next week, we're going to start that coverage, but we're not doing the Votann. We're doing the squats because who they were, where they went, and what they kind of are now, maybe. Honk, honk, here comes the retcon bus.
I was about to say, look out, you're about to get hit by the retcon bus.
Yeah. So next week, Votann. Hope you guys are excited. Probably be at least 2 weeks of Votann coverage to really dive more into them. They're a really interesting group because the way the Votann are written, sort of the lore changes. But I'm excited. Hope you all are as well. I hope you all enjoyed our coverage today of the Ultramarine characters. I know we missed a few. Sorry. They'll come up more in individual stories later. But till then, this has been John Barsotti and Brad Chester.
Yeah.
See you guys next week.